muted, I suppose, option where you could hopefully make some income. I mean, it was run by Rouhani, so it wasn't run by us.
So is the income generating?
So actually our option was something like giving Rouhani an option. You know, what does she want to do and what does her immediate gang want to do? So let's provide that option to her. And so I think, like I say, I think, you know, inevitably, you know, a lot of people started saying, but it's not united anymore. And why isn't it united? Is because people have interfered and people have been, people who shouldn't be around doing things have come around, like the union, you know, they shouldn't be around, actually. And people like James may not, shouldn't be around. I don't know. So, I mean, I can see that that happened. And then one thing that I have to say, which I don't really want to say because I'm very shy about saying this, very embarrassed about it, is that still lots of researchers were coming, actually even more so now, because suddenly everybody wanted to, you know, the militancy of Penang women workers was like, you know, everybody wanted to write about it, all these researchers from all over the place. And so lots of researchers would come in, and now and again I'd meet some of them. And my line generally about research is that, you know, if it doesn't benefit the people you're researching, please don't do it. And so many researchers just come and take all, it's like mining. You just take information, go away, become very famous possibly. And actually the benefit for the people you're actually talking about is zero. So I try and deflect as much as possible. If I was in any position to deflect it, I would, and I still do. But there was this one Swedish or Norwegian researcher who came who, for some reason or other, can't remember quite how. Anyway, I just remember sitting with her on her last evening in Malaysia. And I kind of went into this mode of, which I sometimes do, of, you know, just saying, you know, the morality of research, you know, you need to think about the morality of what you're doing, because you come and research these people, and you're going to go back to Norway. And these people's lives will not have changed because of your research. Your life will have changed. So basically, you're the one who's benefiting from all of this. And what is in it for them? And, you know, I went on and on and on, I remember, to her. And she was very quiet. I always remember she'd hardly said a word. And I was thinking, you know, James, can you stop getting off? Just get off your high chair and calm down. But I was in that mood. So I was just going bang, 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 bang. And off she went to Sweden, to Norway. And actually, it was a time when I also was something like at the end of that period of my life in Malaysia, and I was going back to UK. And I went back to UK, and then, I can't quite remember, or was it just before I went back to UK? Anyway, whatever it was, this blooming woman had gone back to Norway, had taken this very seriously, and had gone back to Norway, but totally wrongly, and had gone back to Norway, and had raised a huge amount of money for the retrenched workers of Penang.
How much?
I can't remember, but it was enough to buy a house, which, you know, is a lot, right? I mean, certainly for women workers in Penang, it was a lot of money. And so this money had come in, and I can't quite remember how it all happened, but it came in to Rouhani, somehow or other. It came into Rouhani. The contact was Rouhani. So they'd contacted each other, and somehow or other the money had come into Rouhani. And Rouhani had bought a house on the basis of it for the project, for her project, which is this income generating
income
plus
generating
thing. But now she extended it to be a dormitory, kind of a house for factory workers. So it was like a place for people to stay. There was income generating activity. There were a lot of things, you know, sewing machines, a lot of things were added on. So it became quite a major sort of project now, but under Rouhani.
Under her name.
And I almost certainly think, because none of us were, I wasn't around, actually no one was around, not that we should have been, because I mean, you know, it just happened like that. But of course what it did, what a lot of people quite understandably said was, you know, how dare James do this and get, because of course people, you know, quite rightly said, you know, this is James's fault that all this money has come into Penang and has gone to one particular group of people which may not have been the right place for it to go at all. Maybe it should have gone into much more sort of militant training, I don't know, whatever. Not militant is the wrong word, you know what I mean? I mean, workers' rights training, much more serious kind of rights building, because although Rouhani was a very strong leader, actually a lot of the activities now were much more something like welfare-based, you know, like a lodging for people, income generating.
Still assist now?
No. So I have to say I was completely shocked when I heard about this. And I didn't know what to do because, you know, it was like, this is not helpful either. I mean, it's extremely helpful for Rouhani, but it's not helpful for the struggle. Because people will say immediately, this is terrible. Because lots of people have put in huge amounts of energy and effort and have a very clear perspective of other ways to go forward, not just the way that Rouhani is going forward. And so why is all this money suddenly going here when it's raised on behalf of the people in Penang, of the women workers in Penang? And who's accountable for the money? And how is that decision made? Et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I have to say that was probably the most embarrassing talk I've ever given to anybody.
And she did not discuss with anybody about this, about the usage of the money?
The Norwegian?
No, I mean Rouhani after she got the money.
No. No, she didn't. Not that
not
I know.
Even you?
Because I was away. I mean, yeah. I mean, I talked a little bit about it, but I mean, it was something like the money has come. It was a real mess, though. It was a real mess. Because there was nothing in there, right? I was never thinking about getting money for anybody. Just never crossed my mind. But, you know, talking to this researcher one evening would result in, you know, hundreds of thousands of ringgit. It must have been, I don't know, those days, 200,000 perhaps to buy a house. I can't remember. So it never crossed my mind. So we were, it was totally unfortunate. But I gave this little speech to this blimming researcher who took it so seriously. To be fair to her, she must have done a fantastic job in Norway to raise the money. But it was not the thing to do. And if she'd said, you know, actually I'm raising this money, I would have said, no, actually I didn't mean that. No, that's not the answer either. You know what I mean? But she'd gone away and thought, you know, how can I help? How can I help in a practical way? So money is the one thing I can do. So I can, you know, from her angle, I can see why she did it. The money comes to Penang, Rouhani's very happy. But in terms of the Mostek struggle, it definitely was not helpful. In fact, it kind of cemented this idea that actually it was all fragmenting and different people had different agendas now. People were doing it for different reasons. So if I look at James, what's James doing? Suddenly he's sort of helping Rouhani set up some income generator. I'm not quite sure. That's not so, you know, not quite what I would have done. And then suddenly he's got all this money to buy a house for Rouhani. And it's like, huh? You know, how does that help anybody? And so it was a bit like that. Yeah.
And what did you do after that?
I was away from Malaysia now, and so I wasn't around.
For how long?
Oh, for years. 7 years I was out.
For 7 years?
Yeah, I mean, I was coming back because we were running a human rights group in London, but I was coming back every year I'd come back. So I would go and see Rouhani. But I mean, the whole struggle, by this is 88, 89 now, right, and into the 90s. Well, by 88, 89, I mean, a lot of things had happened. A lot of things had changed. But I do think, I mean, people, it's difficult to know at these moments what you can expect realistically. You know, certainly the first week of Mostek, it's something like the world can change now because everybody's so ready to demonstrate, to picket, to, you know, and that whole energy, it is so powerful. And you can get swept up in it as you do. And it's like, you know, suddenly the world is going to change. And it's extremely hard work to keep it going. And lots of people put in extremely hard work and very, very powerful energy. But, of course, the forces you're up against are huge, as we all know. You know what I mean? And so the world actually doesn't change so easily, which is very sad, because the world needs to change. But it didn't change. And so people react differently about what happens next. You know, after that initial energy, that fantastic feeling of, you know, we're making a point. How do you go forward from that in a positive way? So people have very different ideas. And so from my point of view, it was something like to support Rahani, whatever way I could, but I didn't mean to get her the money. I certainly, that was not one of my things, but that happened, something like by mistake, which I'm very embarrassed about, of course. And then it's just, you just carry on doing your usual work, you know what I mean, in terms of, I mean, in particular for the, the whole area of free trade zone, of course you want to change the world, but the sort of lobby goes on in terms of very specific lobby points about retrenchment funds. So you need to set up retrenchment funds, we were saying, to state government and national, you know, because you cannot have a situation where suddenly your country people, whether they're women or men, are deprived of their livelihood simply because of the whims and fancies of multinationals or actually even local companies also. You cannot have workers so vulnerable, so unprotected, so betrayed, and so discarded. It just is, it's unacceptable. Even if you sort of vaguely accept the capital, you know, the way the world works, and you know, as bosses and as workers, you have to do better than that. You know, this is, and it was so clear that people can just be treated like complete garbage. And so, of course, you know, rights to unionization, a retrenchment fund that would guarantee immediate support for those retrenched in situations like this. And it happened, unfortunately, it just, you know, that story kept repeating because things have not changed and people are still extremely vulnerable. Workers still have very little rights. In fact, labor, generally speaking, has lost even more of its bargaining power now than it ever had, and, you know, so 30 years later. Far from workers being better protected, they're much worse protected, and, you know, really, really struggle. And yet, you know, governments, stroke companies, stroke capitalists, are in a much more powerful situation now. Much more powerful. So, yeah, I mean, I think people would express, certain people who were part of that whole struggle, certainly would express, I can imagine many people would express serious disappointment at what happened and how it panned out, and would probably say a lot of things about how the cohesion sort of fragmented. I think from my point of view, I would understand that totally. But I would say it is actually extremely difficult to keep a struggle like that going when the people involved directly in the struggle are workers who need income, and so a lot of them had to go and find other things. And it's quite possible we could have had a better strategy at finding ways of supporting people to continue the struggle by fundraising, I don't know, by a different fundraising. But yeah, one is sort of dealing with what is in front of you all the time, and that's the way it went, sort of thing. You know what I mean? Different people had different options. It's just creating options. For me, it's about creating options so that different people can choose where they want to go from here. The workers, and particularly the people directly involved. So, if you want to be militant, there's a chance to be militant. If you want to continue sort of being a women leader, there's an option for that. If you want to be, if you want to form some kind of a company and run a small income generating business, there's an option for that. If you want to get another job, if you want to get another skill, there's an option for that. And so on. So it's something like that. Yes.
All right, so let's come back to the movement. So during the whole, after the retrenchment of Mostek workers, did the employer ever meet up with the site workers?
Yes. Well, yes and no. That's a good question, actually, because as we were saying, you know, throughout the early 1985, the workers actually kept going to the management to say, look, are we okay? And the management kept saying yes and kept reassuring them, even after the voluntary resignation exercise. And of course, then, of course, you know, September, end of September, October, so workers are now sacked. So the first thing that the workers, the first day of a picket, actually the first thing that workers, women workers are asking for is a meeting with management for them to explain actually what is happening. You know, we've worked for you, for many of us have worked for 10 years, and you just kick us out, and you owe us an explanation. At the very least, you owe us an explanation. And actually, it'd be very nice if you gave us more than an explanation and actually told us what was happening and why, suddenly, you know, why are you treating us like this? You know, clear your lockers, take a week off. What nonsense. And then you sack us. I mean, it is absolutely, you know, well, we all know people behave like that, but it's so disgusting. Anyway, so, but not surprising. So the first thing you're asking for the meeting. So, the managing director is Mike Sharp. Mike Sharp, somehow or other, the workers are also going to, it's a big thing now, so Labour Office are involved. So, if I remember, the Labour Office broker a meeting quite early, and certainly within the first week, between management and the workers. So they're told, the workers are told, or the worker lead, I think four of them, can't quite remember, but anyway, a few of them are told, go and meet management are ready to see you. So the workers are not necessarily happy, but they're sort of, at least they're going to meet the management and they'll find out some answers. So they go to the place and they're shown into this room and they sit in this room. And then they're all, you know, nervous, excited, waiting for the management to come in. Then the management don't come in. And then the Labour Office guy comes in. And then the workers say, you know, where's the management? And the Labour Office said, the poor bloke, I can just imagine he's in this terrible situation. Anyway, so he says to them, actually, the management are sitting in the next room, but they don't want to meet you. But I will interpret between you two. I will be the bridge between you two. Can you imagine? So here, the workers are sitting in one room. The management are sitting in another room. This is a management for whom you've worked for maybe 10 years, who have been telling you all this time, we're one big happy family, we're all brothers and sisters together, and we're part of the same global, you know, and we love each other forever. And now, at this time, when you've sacked your family, and now you can't even have the courage to face them in the same room. My goodness. And so they're sitting in this blimming room and sending his Labour Office guy to say, find out what the workers want to know. And then come back and tell us. And then whatever we answer, you go and tell the workers. So it's absolutely nonsense. And so if ever there was an event or a symbol of how management treat workers, that was it. And the workers, it just fueled the anger. They were so insulted. You can imagine. I mean, how insulting, how denigrating, insulting, you know, it's just nonsense. And so, of course, the workers got even more militant after that. And why not? Blimming act. I would have, you know, they should have just gone and killed
them.
What
was the outcome of the meeting?
No outcome at all. Because it was a ridiculous meeting. It was a complete, it was nonsense. So the workers, the outcome of the meeting was that the workers understood that the management were completely and utter assholes from beginning to end and had been talking nonsense for 10 years. And all this stuff about, you know, we're one big happy family, forget it. We're one big happy family as long as I'm making lots of profit out of you. Once you're not profitable to me, I'm going to sack you and I don't care what happens to you. And I even don't care enough to tell you to your face, I'm sorry. So, for the workers, it's like, slap me again, hit me again. Now I understand. That's all, you know. You're just going to hit. You have no respect at all. Not a modicum of respect for me. And so, very clear. But we're just fuel for your profit. And when you don't need us, you're out. And the same thing happened a little bit with, I mean, as we were saying, you know, the state government reaction was also pathetic. And I mean, first of all, lots of promises, lots of reassurance, exactly what the management had done. Everything's okay, we'll find you jobs, you don't have to worry, leave it to us, we'll sort you out. But in the end, nothing. So it's like just words, you know. And then swinging the other way, but you know, you start blaming, the state government started blaming the workers, you know, and you're lazy and you should be finding jobs, and why aren't you, you know, why are you speaking so much, and all that, something like we were saying a little bit before. Lots of amazing quotes about all sorts of things. And the national government also. So I remember Mathieu came one, I can't actually remember the timing, so I'm sorry, but Mathieu came once to give a speech in Butterworth on some, remembered occasion. So this was one of the few times where all the groups at that time, MTUC, the other union, Electrical Industry Workers Union, of course the women workers, lots of the other people being retrenched, so they also had their leadership, Urban Services Project, and one or two hangers-on like me. There was a march. I can't remember where we marched from, but I remember marching down Butterworth and basically with placards saying, where is our job? Where are our jobs? Manada Kaja, something like that. And arrived at the Padang in Butterworth. And Mathieu, it was a big thing, so Mathieu, you know, a big platform at one end of the thing, and lots of people. And Mathieu was to address the crowd. So the group stood at something like at the back, because it was actually very crowded. And then when Mathieu came up, we started chanting. When I say we, I mean, I was nothing, you know, irrelevant. So all the workers and everybody started chanting. And I remember Mathieu just sort of at the beginning, in his usual way, just sort of tried to ignore it. But actually the chanting was quite powerful, quite loud. And so in the end, he just said, you know, these workers, telling the crowd, these workers or these people, you know, but too lazy to get jobs. They should shut up and just get on with their lives and stop moaning and all this sort of stuff. And that's your prime minister telling you, basically, I'm not only telling you that I'm not interested in your problem, telling the rest of the crowd that these people are a problem. Can you imagine? So again, I mean, it was very clear to everybody that, you know, who is actually on your side? No one except yourselves.
Were you there?
Yeah, I was standing somewhere. Yeah, but I mean, it was just one of those moments again when you could just feel the anger and the, you know, some people obviously didn't have too much confidence because they sort of kind of understood what AMLO and BN in the end stood for, a bit like the state government. So when push comes to shove, you know, Malaysian government, state government, absolutely are not going to upset the multinationals. So there's something like being blackmailed by the multinationals. And this is actually one explanation of why there was never an electronic union. It's because the multinationals, especially the American multinationals, are saying we don't want unions. So don't you dare allow unions. If you allow a union, we will pull out. So there's always this thing about pull out. And many people would say they're bluffing, you know, because actually Malaysia at that time had a lot of assets, assets, not quite the right word, but there was a lot of reasons why multinationals would want to stay in Malaysia and not go to Thailand or Vietnam in those days, were just not quite opened up yet, so it wasn't really an option. But, you know, the sort of lower wage, because of course it's a race at the bottom. Everybody was talking about a race at the bottom, and the multinationals will go to where the lowest wages are. And so everybody was trying to lower their wages to get the multinationals. So, like, you know, you'd create worse conditions than you would want, only because you want your multinationals to come and invest, apparently invest in your country, give employment. So Thailand, for example, would be paying lower wages than Malaysia, right? But multinationals would choose Malaysia, would be willing to pay a little bit more to come to Malaysia. because Malaysia had better golf courses, better highways, better infrastructure. Language in those days was actually quite important. So the fact that, you know, English was quite widely understood and spoken. So there's lots of reasons why multinationals would not want to move from Malaysia. And, you know, if one never knows, but if a government told them, actually, we're going to allow electronic unions because we believe in them, I suspect multinationals, many of them would not run away at all and would deal with it in a way that they have dealt with unions in other places. They wouldn't welcome them, but they, you know, I mean, you know, you're the government of Malaysia. You set the rules. Why are the multinationals setting the rules? And this is global, this is the way of the world, right? This is global capitalism. Is that, you know, governments now, and as demonstrated in those days, don't set the rules. There's something like beholden. It's a little bit more than that, of course, because if you look at what AMNO and BN represent, they certainly don't represent workers. They represent capitalists in Malaysia, right? And crony capitalism. So you wouldn't expect them anyway to unionize. But anyway, but you know, the power of the multinationals and the way that they just put down, that's why we all, you know, if Malaysia signs TPPA, for example, mm-hmm. I mean, this is just the next step. You know, you just sell your soul to decision make being made in places you have absolutely no control over. And the decisions are not being made in favor of workers. They're being made in favor of capital all the time. And that's what's been happening, you know, over the last, well, depending on how long you wanted to go, 200 years. And it's just, you know, capital is just getting better and better at controlling everything. And labor is losing and losing and losing. So I think one of the inspirations from Mostek, because people might say, you know, Mostek hasn't changed anything. So yeah, so it was all very exciting for a little bit, and we, you know, everybody jumped up and down, and it was, you know, the fact that it was women workers jumping up and down is something like also interesting. They're not meant to jump up and down. But actually, nothing's changed. So, you know, what's so important about Mostek? And the answer for me is that, you know, we're at a place in history, always, and now we're at a place in history where we can see very clearly that the world is ruled by a very few people, and by decisions are made which fundamentally affect the world and fundamentally affect the majority of the people in the world badly, and they're made because it's self-interest and it's about maximizing your profit and your protection of your profit. And to do that, you basically exploit environment, you exploit workers, you exploit people, you exploit communities, and you undermine any protection that they may be able to may be able to create. And so the only way, and that's been getting worse and worse since Mostek, since 85, is actually worse now. So if we're interested in challenging that, well, actually, we need to be interested in challenging that, because if we don't challenge it, then it'll just get worse. And it means, you know, there'll be more and more people in our world, but especially in Malaysia, who are completely vulnerable to any downturn or crisis in the financial world, which are always, you know, the way capitalism works is it staggers from one boom to a bust to a crisis to a boom to a bust to a crisis. And it's not the rich who pay the price, it's the poor always who pay the price. So Mostek is a really good example of, it just reveals this completely clearly, because a lot of it is hidden. You know, people go to work now, you know, we get on our buses, we go to work, we get our wage, and it's not a good wage, and we, you know, but somehow or other we can manage. But the day will come when something will happen and we won't get on that bus because we've been sacked, and there won't be alternative because there's no alternative, and the government is not going to support us because suddenly the government has run a mile. And so Mostek, you know, incidences like Mostek reveal absolutely clearly actually what the situation is in terms of where you are in the whole global production line. And if you're a woman worker in particular, you are, as I say, garbage in a dustbin. As quickly as that, you can be garbage in a dustbin. And we need to take that lesson and put it into ourselves and say to ourselves, we're not willing to be in a world like this anymore. And we need to find ways of making sure that we're not. And of course, again, then what is the next step? So lots of different people have lots of different ideas about what the next step is. But whatever it is, we cannot maintain, we cannot allow the status quo to continue. And we cannot allow the status quo to continue because it's not continuing as a status quo, because the people who control things are getting more and more powerful, and the people who don't control things are getting less and less powerful. And we're just creating a world where this is, you know, if you read all the science fiction, which I love reading,